Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Richie Neal, tell me about state politics in Massachusetts. There are those of us who have some feelings that Martha Coakley might not be up to the job of winning against Charlie Baker. Now, I would predict you're going to say, oh, yes, she can and she will and all the rest of it. But the state party at their nominating convention sure didn't seem to think she was the person to carry the flag, and yet she won the primary.
Well, I think the emphasis that you raised is the correct one, and that is she can win. Obviously, when you have a voter registration in a state that's better than 3-1, that obviously puts any Democratic candidate in pretty strong position with the base of the party. The challenge in Massachusetts, as you know, is basically this, that less than 11% of the voters now call themselves Republicans, and about 33-34% call themselves Democrats, and 54% now call themselves independent. And the trick, obviously, if for a Democratic candidate now, is you're going to have to drive up a turnout in the old cities of the state, and you're going to have a good turnout in a year where you will not have a Democratic presidential aspirant on the ballot. And understand that the suburban vote now in Massachusetts tilts decidedly in Hampden, Worcester, and Essex counties, and also in Barnstable, and not to miss the point that there are areas that have great appeal for a Republican who runs as a suburban independent. Now, I think that Martha has done a good job of nailing down the base of the Democratic Party, but in politics, I'm always pained when I hear people have these discussions without pointing out that politics is about addition, not subtraction.
Well, it's also about character, isn't it? I mean, people have to perceive her as being charismatic, and I don't think she's been able to portray that up to now. We know that she lost that Senate race.
Well, I also think that there's a challenge that comes to anybody who's been the Attorney General in Massachusetts. I often caution some of the candidates who have come through here nationally who have been Attorneys General who are seeking congressional seats, and I will always say to them, just remember in the course of the conversation that it's not about being Sergeant Joe Friday, that it's a very different lexicon and it's a very different skill set. And seldom in political life are there simple yes and no answers.
Well, yeah, but why do we like you? We like you because you're straightforward. You can explain things to us. You have a charisma. That isn't true with Martha Coakley.
Well, I think that you have, again, I think part of the danger here is that seldom is there an absolute moment in politics.
Yeah.
And instead, that you often sit in a room with people that sharply disagree with you. And the idea is that even if they disagree with you, to try to find a common path forward. And I think frequently for those who hold law enforcement jobs, that becomes a bigger challenge. And I think that they're so used to dealing, again, with juries that say yes or no, that I think that that skill set is very, very different. And I think that there tends to be a kind of reticence about being candid with the news media. So I think it's a problem more in the DNA of individuals who hold law enforcement jobs than it is to a particular individual.
Not to debate this ad nauseum with you, but in New York...
But you're doing well.
But in New York State, the attorney generals always get to be governor.
Well, I think that in Massachusetts, we've had a long history of that being just the opposite, dating back to Frank Bellotti and Bob Quinn.
Sure.
Those are two that come to mind. Tom Riley comes to mind. Scott Harshbarger comes to mind.
Yeah.
So it is not exactly in Massachusetts been a launching pad to the governor's office.
You're such a great political analyst. Let me ask you a question. You know, I debated this in my class the other day, and I know you teach, and I know I'm sure it's come up with you, too. Is it a good idea? I'm as you say, independent or small I or unenrolled voter in Massachusetts. I can go into either party. And my kids always say, yeah, but you could go in and vote for the bad Republican candidate in order to screw them all up. So it should be the New York way, which is one party or the other. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that what's happened in Massachusetts, there's been a dramatic change from the time I started in the sense that our economic success has generated a whole wave of new citizens who have come from different parts of the country. I use the example because I used to represent many of those communities in the 495 Beltway of Massachusetts. And typically it was the EMC employee that had begun to arrive by the hundreds in those
EMC,
towns.
EMC?
EMC.
Which is?
It's a data storage operation that is one of the largest companies in America.
Gotcha.
And they employ literally tens of thousands of people. And they don't come with the idea that many of us had about the New Deal, the Great Society, or the New Frontier, or the Fair Deal on the Democratic side. And they not necessarily are attuned to the Reagan phenomena of a more combative spirit internationally and less government domestically. Theirs is a movement from election to election. Hmm. And you can see how their attitudes are changed. They tend to be socially fairly liberal, but fiscally very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in our state, they are the ones overwhelmingly now in that 495 Beltway who will drive this gubernatorial election.
So, but back to my question, should we have a system where I'm allowed to vote in either party, or should I, as in the New York case, which I don't like, if you're not registered in a party, you don't get to vote in the primary?
Well, I that would not happen in Massachusetts any longer, because I think when you do polling, one of the things that you will say, for example, in a poll to an independent voter, you will say, did you vote in the last election? And if they say yes, you will ask, well, what ballot did you ask for?
Yeah.
And in the election before that. And what you try to do is you go back three elections, even though you add lines that are costly to the questionnaire. You go back three elections, and if you've got an individual who says that they've asked for a Democratic ballot, although they're mm-hmm. independents in three successive elections, chances are pretty good they're going to vote Democratic.
You got a Democrat. And how come in Massachusetts, I know we've struggled with this one before, but how come in Massachusetts Republicans can win considering the overwhelming blueness of the state?
Well, I would map a strategy for a Republican, and I have always thought that in my case, I've never been in a campaign where any consultant could tell me how to run the campaign. Mm. I certainly listen to advice, but at the same time, my instincts will tell me how the campaign is going to turn out, and I have been certainly more right than I've been wrong.
And you're still there, and you're doing well.
But part of that is I could map out a campaign for a Republican candidate for governor. I mean, one of the things that Baker did immediately was to accept the nomination of a party and to reject their platform principles
almost
simultaneously.
And in the past, he was more Tea Party than he is now, isn't he?
That's clear. And he's going to have a very different message this time around. And Martha will have a very different message this time around. But I can tell you exactly, it's going to be a battle over Beacon Hill. And you can see how this will be mapped out, and the strategists will put it together. And I think that it's not rocket science. You had a campaign that Bill Weld ran, that Paul Cellucci ran, and that clearly Mitt Romney ran, and it was all aimed at Beacon Hill.
And in each case, if you're running for governor, it's not as if our very bright people know that if they elect a Republican congressman, that person's going to vote for John Boehner. Whereas,
that's exactly right. And but, you know, even that is a bit of a stretch in terms of the argument that we've tried to make back in 96 when we kept saying in our candidacies across the country that if you voted for a Republican member of Congress, they were going to vote for Newt Gingrich to be the Speaker of the House. That is a difficult argument to make.
Because
you can do it in some swing districts, but on an overall basis, that's a very, very difficult district to make. And you will see that Republicans this year around, they will say that a vote for a Democrat is a vote for Nancy Pelosi to be the Speaker of the House. And that's just how these campaigns play out.
But shouldn't we have more national? I mean, it's always seemed to me somebody should stand up and say, I can't do my job. I'm Barack Obama. I can't do my job without Democrats voting in Congress for me.
I agree. I think that in principle, what you said is very sound. In practice, it's very different. There are two dramatic changes that have occurred during my time in Congress that I think have also shifted the strident campaign rhetoric. And one is the demise of Southern Democrats, and two is the demise of Northeastern Republicans. I frequently say to our Democratic leadership, where else are we going to win a seat in New England? We've won them all.
Yeah.
And where do you want a seat in California? So the argument becomes, how do we go back to holding on to those Southern Democrats who would vote with us 65% to 70% of the time, but they would vote to allow us to organize the House? And that was the vote that we needed. And now they're in very, very short supply. And when you look at this cycle of elections, you might see an opportunity in West Virginia. I think there's a seat that might be available in Tennessee. But other than that, that playing field is pretty limited and pretty narrow. And when we had two, I think, very successful initiatives led by Pelosi and Rahm Emanuel, it was because in two successive elections, we picked up people in the Midwest and in the old Confederacy, and that gave us a working majority.
Brilliant, as always. Richie Neal has been our guest. Richie, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks very, very much, Alan.